People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Today on the program, what happens when people use drug checking services and find something unexpected? A BC study took a look. And after years of renovations, the Salvation Army's Center of Hope in downtown Nanaimo is gearing up to open a new wing. We'll pay a visit. Plus, the Nanaimo Men's Shed is creating connection and searching for a new space. Welcome to People First Radio. A study out of BC asks, what happens when someone finds unexpected substances in their drugs? Published in the Harm Reduction Journal, the study surveyed close to 450 people who used drug checking services in BC. Around 40% of them found an unexpected active ingredient. 24 people in the survey reported discarding the drugs without using them. 11 reported taking a smaller dose. Lian Ping Ti is the corresponding author on the study. I reached her to put things in context.
I am Lian Ping Ti. I am an assistant professor at the University of British Columbia and a research scientist with the BC Center on Substance Use.
And what did you set out to look for in this study around drug checking and risk reduction behavior?
The purpose of the study was really to try to understand the relationship between detecting an unexpected active drug within a drug checking sample for folks who come in to check their drugs, and then subsequent engagement in risk reduction practices, which we defined from a various number of things, including using less, not using alone, disposing of the drug, and things like that.
Can you give me a quick zoom out context perspective on how drug checking works for people who might not be familiar?
So how drug checking works, generally, the service is meant to inform people about the contents of their drug sample so that they can make informed decisions. So whether or not it's informed decisions to use or to sell or to share. And drug checking in BC has really been offered since 2017 as a harm reduction tool to address the unregulated drug supply and the drug toxicity crisis. Although the concept of drug checking isn't new, it's been around since, you know, back in the day when it was used mostly in festival and music settings. So, you know, generally, people bring in their drugs, get them checked. You know, in British Columbia, most of the drug checking sites offer what we call FTIR, which is a Fourier transform infrared spectroscopy, a fancy word, you know, in combination with test strips. And we use this in combination, mostly because the use of one of these technologies, obviously they have some limitations. For example, the FTIR can test a lot of substances at one time, but has a limit of detection, so wouldn't be able to detect something at really low levels. Whereas the test strips have a lower limit of detection, but is qualitative in nature, so can only really tell you, yes, there's this particular drug in it or no. And while we use these two in combination, there's obviously a lot of other types of technologies that have been used, not only within the province, but also elsewhere. Maybe I'll also just say that, you know, in addition to people getting their drugs checked, you know, once the results are delivered by a trained drug checking technician, there's some harm reduction messaging that that is shared also with the individual who gets their drug checked.
So if I get my drugs checked, someone is going to communicate what the results were to me, and they're also going to communicate some messaging. What would the messaging be? What would that harm reduction messaging be?
So I'm personally not a drug checking technician, but I can say harm reduction messaging that, there's general harm reduction messaging, which is don't use alone, maybe use a little bit at a time. But then there's also can be specific harm reduction messaging depending on the substance that shows up in your results. Like, if there's benzodiazepines in your what you thought was fentanyl, harm reduction messaging around that. Which can the technician might be able to tell the individual who brings in their sample some of the potential harms associated with having benzos in their drug.
Got you. So you're highlighting for people that, like, if someone brings in a drug to get checked, not only will they get the results, but there will be someone who is working at that site who can explain to them, hey, this is what we found. This is what this might do differently than what you were expecting.
Exactly.
In general, what are the drugs that people are bringing in to get checked in the first place?
The large proportion of drugs that come in are opioids. So whether or not people are bringing in what they think is fentanyl or what we'd call down, and other types of opioids, I'd say the majority, and then to a much lesser extent. Stimulants, so cocaine, crack cocaine, methamphetamine, and then even to a lesser extent, depressants and psychedelics as well.
And in the study we're talking about today, there were 447 people who checked drugs. 174 of them found an active ingredient that it wasn't what they thought the drug was. What can you tell me about what kinds of things people are finding in their drugs that they weren't necessarily expecting to?
For the most part, because folks are mostly checking what they expect to be opioids or fentanyl or down, the most common unexpected substance that they're finding are benzodiazepines. So in our study, we found, I believe, 35% of opioids had benzodiazepines in them. This is slightly lower than what we see, generally in the province. I think it's around 40 to 45% in the province.
And so, if 174 people found something that they weren't expecting or wasn't what they wanted the drug to be necessarily, what did those people do?
I think what we found in our study is that there is, about, I want to say, almost 40% of people, among the people who had unexpected active drugs in the sample, were finding that a quarter, more or less, reported engaging in some sort of risk reduction behavior. And as I mentioned, when I say that, I mean things like took less. Took a tester, split their dose into a smaller dose, or didn't use alone. The most common risk reduction behavior we found was that folks were disposing of the drug without using it, followed by taking a smaller dose and then also giving it away. If you think about the inverse, there are people who take drugs or who don't engage in a risk reduction behavior. So folks who are taking drugs as it was originally intended to, or took more or things like that. And what I like to use, I've heard this one example that has kind of stuck with me throughout this research that I've been doing is an example around grocery shopping. So if you think about I go into the grocery store and I want to buy a bag of cookies and I'm looking at the nutrition facts and the labels, now there's high sodium, high sugars, things like that. And so even though the point of drug checking is to provide people with more information about the drugs that they're using, similar to the nutrition facts in my cookie bag. And so, it doesn't necessarily mean I'm not going to purchase that bag of cookies and consume them. But, now I know that I have more information about the cookies or the drugs that I'm about to consume.
Well, on that theme, how do you relate or compare what happened in your study and your sample with what would have happened in a world where, say, there was no drug checking?
I think there's a lot of, you know, monitoring and evaluation and research that's been done that has shown that the unregulated drug supply is so unpredictable and dynamic and changes constantly. And so if we were in a world where there was no drug checking, that's one less harm reduction tool we can use, in our toolkit of harm reduction tools that include things like expanding naloxone distribution and supervised consumption sites, overdose prevention sites, expansion of addiction treatment. You know, that's just, you know, one less thing that we can do, to reduce the harms that are associated with substance use.
What can you tell me as far as the demographics of people who were using the drug checking services?
That's a tricky question because, the study sample that, we are working with is a, you know, sample of folks who voluntarily consent to be interviewed. And so this sample of folks are definitely potentially could be a different group of folks and shouldn't necessarily be generalized to the larger population of people who might use drug checking services. The challenge with trying to understand the demographic a little bit more is that drug checking services inherently is an anonymous service. Because of that, it's hard to really try to get at the demographics. But I will say, you know, in the particular study that, you know, of the 447 folks who did participate in this study, the folks were mostly in their mid-40s. I'd say a third were women. Most folks were using opioids.
Well, how does the fact that we're in a situation right now where there are harm reduction measures like drug checking, like supervised consumption sites, folks who use drugs are encouraged to go and make use of these services, but we're also in a system where there's no legal protection for, say, like having drugs while you're walking on the street on your way to go use the service that you're being encouraged to use. How do some of those factors influence just the whole context that you're doing this research in?
There are definitely challenges. I'm not a service provider, but I could, it's not restricted to drug checking. So there are, there's a long history of research that's shown barriers to accessing harm reduction services, for fear of a variety of things. And so the fact that, drug checking services currently are largely offered within supervised consumption sites or overdose prevention sites, also potentially introduces barriers to folks who, use drugs but don't necessarily want to go into a supervised consumption site to get their drugs checked. So, by having drug checking services embedded within existing overdose prevention sites, supervised consumption sites, there are, I guess, limitations as to who is getting their drugs checked. Yeah.
It is like an inference to make through what you're saying there. Like if there is someone who is going to go use drugs at a party on the weekend or something, and that's something that they're going to do, they might be afraid of walking into the supervised consumption site for fear that everyone is going to know that they're there and using drugs, basically.
Yeah, or, there's folks who, studies have shown that folks, who maybe don't live in the downtown east side, for example, where a lot of the overdose prevention sites and supervised consumption sites are located, may not necessarily want to, go into a supervised consumption site to check their drugs. So there's definitely some sort of selection bias in terms of who accesses those services.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. My guest is Lianping Ti. She's a research scientist with the BC Center on Substance Use and an assistant professor at the University of British Columbia. We're talking about drug checking. Ti co-authored a study exploring what people did when they found unexpected substances in their drugs. That study appeared in the Harm Reduction Journal in March. What do you think are the big findings or results or takeaways from this study?
One of the big takeaways really is that, drug checking can play an important role in harm reduction, in trying to curb the, deaths associated with the unregulated drug supply. It's not the end all be all, I'd say. It's, definitely just one important tool. It's important for people to have as much information about what they are using in the context of a very unpredictable, unregulated drug supply that changes so drastically over time with the introduction of novel psychoactive substances, whether or not they're sedatives or otherwise. Yeah, so I would say that's probably the main takeaway from this study.
And you've shared that a number of people were getting opioids checked. The most common thing that showed up that they didn't necessarily want to be there were benzodiazepines. What is the consequence of that? Could you spell out for someone how the drug is different when there are benzodiazepines in it, and what the consequence is of that for the person using it if they choose to follow through and use it?
Mm-hmm. So benzodiazepines are sedatives. They make people who use them more drowsy, slows down their brain activity. When prescribed, it's used to treat things like anxiety, insomnia, but in an unregulated drug market, it's, increasingly over the last few years, and I think it's plateaued at about, 40 or so percent in opioids. It's hypothesized to be, adulterated in fentanyl to make the drug last longer. But because it's being adulterated in a, very unpredictable and unregulated way, it's really variable if and how much there is in opioid samples. And so it makes that a big challenge, not only in the sense that it makes it more difficult to reverse an overdose if one does happen, because naloxone that's used to reverse an overdose related to fentanyl doesn't affect benzodiazepine. Not only that, but it also makes it really difficult for clinicians to treat people who are coming in for addiction treatment for opioid use disorder, for example, because people are being put on opioid agonist therapy for their opioid use disorder, but, without knowing that, there's benzos in their opioids, folks may be experiencing things like atypical withdrawal, like benzo-driven seizures and things like that.
Is there anything that people can do in the wake of this beyond throwing their drug out or using a smaller dose?
I think, and I think this is where drug checking, comes into play really importantly, is that by knowing that there's benzos or not in someone's drugs can really shape how it can be used or will be used. I will say that this study concluded prior to, there's a lot of kind of data now that's showing metatomidine and, other types of sedatives coming into the drug supply. And this study wasn't there to capture that, but had the study still ongoing, could potentially have seen an emergence of metatomidine, which is what the drug checking services through the province is seeing as a very common unexpected active substance showing up in the opioid supply.
And if we're thinking of the story of, say, fentanyl replacing heroin circa a decade or more ago in the drug supply, is it reasonable? First of all, is that a reasonable thing for people to have in their heads? And second of all, if so, is the entrance of benzodiazepines into the fentanyl supply, is that fair to understand along the same lines?
Yeah, I would say that... I could say with more confidence now than I could 5 years ago that, benzos in the opioid supply are probably here to stay. We've seen in the data since 2017, there's been a huge increase in the prevalence of benzos adulterating the opioid supply. In the last couple of years, I'd say it's been pretty plateaued at around the 40% mark that I was saying. So I do think that is here to stay. Now, I think the other question is around, will it change again? And what would that look like? We're seeing now that, the most common benzo that was adulterating the supply is bromazolam. But, now we're seeing other types of benzodiazepine analogs that are, in the opioid supply. And we don't know very much about the potency or kind of the physiological implications of these types of analogs. Like, is it like, fentanyl that's, much stronger than heroin? Are these different types of benzo analogs? Do they have different potency? And should we be more or less concerned about, these different types of analogs that are showing up in the drug supply?
And drug checking is framed as a way for individuals who are going to be using drugs to have more information about what it is they're actually going to be using, and then to maybe use that information to potentially save their lives and throw out a bad batch, say. But what can drug checking do as far as helping society keep track of how the drug supply is evolving and how we can react to that?
Yeah, so, there are these individual potential benefits of drug checking to, kind of help make decisions about people's use. But you're right, there are, more population level type, monitoring benefits of drug checking. If widespread enough, which, in BC, I think we're quite fortunate in that, drug checking services are available in, many different, cities across the province and all the health authorities, that, we could take all this information and really map out what we're seeing in near real time, and at the BC Center on Substance Use and our colleagues at Substance at the University of Victoria have been able to do that over time. And they publish monthly, if not more frequent reports on the drug supply at the BC Center on Substance Use. We have a publicly facing dashboard of the unregulated drug supply that gets up, new data gets uploaded from the drug checking sites every week, I want to say, and folks can look at that and look at trends as well.
And our conversation is about your study that looked into around 450 people's individual experience of drug checking. It found about 40% of them found something unexpected in their drugs. How representative do you think that is of drug checking in general? Like, do you think, is there anything in particular about the sample in the study we need to be careful of if we're trying to draw generalizations about whether or not it applies to maybe the whole situation of people checking their drugs in the province?
Yeah, there's definitely limitations to our studies. Like, for example, the selection bias I think I mentioned is, these are folks who come in to check their drugs, but then also agree to do a survey, an interviewer-administered survey with us, which, could take a little bit of time. So these are folks who, may want to engage with that, and those folks may be different from, generally people who check their drugs, and then more widely, maybe different for people who use unregulated drugs, because these are folks who are coming in for a service, so engage in some sort of health and harm reduction service already. I think there's definitely limitations, but I think when one of the strengths is that we have been able to show with this data that there are potential benefits, individual benefits to the use of drug checking services, and that it should definitely be continued to be included in a suite of harm reduction services for people who use unregulated drugs.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to the conversation today, either about your study or any of the subjects we've been talking about?
Not necessarily. I feel like we covered a lot of ground here. And in speaking just about the study and this was part of a larger evaluation of drug checking services within BC, and there's still obviously a lot of work to be done, not only by our research team, but also others out there, especially in the context that we're in. We're seeing declines in unregulated drug toxicity deaths, but that's not to say that the drug supply is not even more complex than it was years ago. And so being able to use drug checking not just for the individual advantages that it may have, but also being able to use drug checking services or the data that comes out of drug checking services to continue to monitor the unregulated drug supply, in order to make kind of plans in terms of the technologies that we are using, which inevitably we'll need to involve depending on what is showing up in the drug supply, but also with respect to how to treat folks who have opioid use disorder or other types of use disorders who are ready to seek treatment.
Yanping Ti, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me about it.
Thank you, Joe.
Lianping Ti is an assistant professor at the University of British Columbia and a research scientist with the BC Centre on Substance Use. We were talking about a study she co-authored into people's risk reduction behaviors after finding unexpected substances during drug checking. That study was published in the Harm Reduction Journal this past March.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
After years of construction work, new shelter space is expected to open this month in downtown Nanaimo. The Salvation Army Center of Hope is located at 19 Nickel Street. Formerly known as the New Hope Center, it houses a shelter and other outreach programming. Construction has been ongoing since 2023 for a new four-story expansion at the site that's going up in place of a now-demolished 19th century building. Last week, as the finishing touches were being applied, Executive Director Bern Muller spoke with me about plans for the new space.
Well, thanks very much. My name is Bern Muller. I'm the executive director of the Salvation Army Center of Hope in downtown Nanaimo, 19 Nickel Street.
And some renovations are almost finished. We are standing in that building. It is going to be ready to open in June, you've told me. What do these renovations? What are they going to allow you to do?
Well, we're super excited to be opening this facility. It's going to give us an additional 34 spaces for people to shelter. And while they're sheltering with us, we will continue to provide services to support them and to help them as they move in a journey towards wellness and recovery. The main floor of our building provides a dining space and a commercial kitchen. And we'll be using that to feed people who are registered and staying with us in our shelter, as well as opening it for windows during the day for people who are not in a shelter to be able to come in and to access some food, a cup of coffee, and that sort of thing.
And the building we're standing in is new. It is gone in the space of a building that was from 1893 that was knocked down to build these new renovations. While that's all been going on, you've still been operating a little bit out of half of the building. What has that been like? What have you been able to do while these renovations have been going on?
Thank you. It's a great question because we've had all of our residents staying in the one side of our building. That dorm has been accommodating 34 people, and it is being renovated in a matter of months. So that renovation is going to renew the building, especially for washroom, showers, the heating and cooling, and the air system for the new building, for the renovated building. Those guests will be serviced in program space that's going to be across the main floor of both buildings where they're conjoined on the Nickel Street side. We'll be able to provide programming to people who are registered to stay with us, as well as offering services to people who are not registered in a shelter. It's really important that people become connected to community services and that they're able to find places where they're able to get help and to support that they need to be able to move forward in life.
Could you walk me through how someone registers at the shelter? What are kind of the things they need to do on their end, and what are the things you need to do on your end for someone to be able to come and stay at the shelter?
Absolutely. People who are needing shelter will come to our door in the morning, and they'll ask if there's space. If we have space, then there's an intake process where that person will meet with one of our caseworkers and will determine if we are in fact able to help and support that person. If we are able to help them, they'll be brought into the facility, and then there will be the beginning of a sequence of steps where we have meaningful conversations, and we determine what kinds of supports we're able to put in place to help that person. Initially, when someone comes into a shelter, they have a very, very simple list of needs. They need a safe place to be. They need a warm meal, a warm shower, and some clean clothes. After they've had an opportunity to have a night's rest, our caseworkers will meet with them and start to determine where the barriers are that are preventing that person from being able to have a more self-directed life.
And what is the demand that you're seeing for the shelter? Are you having to turn people away every night? Do you know roughly how many?
There's a huge need. Our city has had steadily increasing point-in-time count numbers, which is a measure of homelessness. There are very limited shelter beds in the city. We're extremely excited to be able to offer this increase in numbers and to be able to offer the programming that helps people to move forward and to become more self-sufficient.
And so the building we're standing in is multiple stories, is brand new construction. How have you been able to make this happen?
Yeah, that's also an excellent question, because the Salvation Army is guided by a principle where they want to answer human need where they see it. And in Nanaimo, we see a tremendous amount of human need. The building that we have constructed meets modern building standards, and it is not inexpensive to build a purpose-built facility. But the four stories that we have built are internally funded by the Salvation Army. We will be again inviting people to participate in our Hope Luncheon, which happens in November each year. We'll be approaching the community and explaining how this is an opportunity for them to make a constructive and impactful change for people who are unable to make that change for themselves. So we're hopeful that community sponsors and donations will help us to cover the cost of this building.
And you were explaining to me that the hope on your end is that by the winter, the building you've got now that has still been in operation, you'll be able to use that as a winter shelter. Can you explain?
That's correct. We're hoping that that building will be ready for service after the renovations, and that for the winter of 2026, we'll be able to open those doors as a winter shelter, offering 34 beds to the community, as well as hopefully offering space for some mats. When the weather becomes extremely cold, the city of Nanaimo opens mat program across the city. So there are limited mats, but where we have space and where we're able to accommodate people, different service providers try to step in and to provide warm shelter for a person to sleep on the floor.
And the 34 beds you mentioned, that would be a new service. That's not something you've offered in past winters?
That's correct. We haven't had the space previously, but because of these new four floors that have been added to our building, we now have an additional 34 beds. That takes us to 68.
And you were talking about the process where caseworkers, if someone is staying in the shelter, will try and kind of get to know them, if maybe once they've stabilized or been here for a while, try and identify maybe what is preventing them from getting housing. Could you talk me through what you have seen happen in some of those cases, if there have been people that you have helped find housing and how that has worked?
Right. That's also an excellent question. Our caseworkers will meet with each of our guests at least once a week. If our guests have other questions and would like additional supports, they can meet more frequently. Our chaplain will also meet with every guest on a regular basis. And what we're trying to determine is how can we connect the person who is staying with us with services in the community that can continue to support them. The Salvation Army is a place where people can land and where we can help them to progressing their own healing and wholeness so that they are able to access other community services and government services as they move forward in independence. So we're working closely with a lot of community partners, and wherever possible, we want to introduce people to resources that they will be able to continue to access even after they leave our facility.
Do you have a sense of, and I know we're talking about a new building that's going to open up that is going to provide more shelter spaces than you've had before, but with what you've already been doing, do you have a sense of, say, in the last year or so, how many or if there have been people that you've connected to sort of full-time housing elsewhere in the community?
Yeah, people do leave our facility and successfully move into either transitional shelter space that's available, or sometimes people who have stayed with us, they choose to enroll in a program that we call a Pathway of Hope, which can extend their stay while they continue to work sometimes on a certification or some other kind of a tool that's going to help them to access market housing. We have guests who leave our facility having made acquaintance here, or they partner with someone else who's in a similar situation, and they've successfully moved into rental. Sometimes they move into transitional housing. But people who have a desire to recover and a desire to develop their own capacity for self-determination, they do receive support of the Salvation Army that helps them to move in that direction.
Just a couple of months ago, a drop-in hub that was located not far from where we're having this conversation closed down. Have you seen that closure make an impact in your work? Like, have you been able to notice the difference since it is closed?
Yes, all across the city, there are service providers that have taken steps to mobilize. There are a lot of vehicles on the road that are providing supports of all kinds, innovative ways to provide support to the street community and people who are in need of those supports. One of the things that the Salvation Army has done, we've added a meal program, which is provided through an EDS, we call it an emergency response vehicle, that our division, our provincial body, has stationed here in Nanaimo. And we drive that vehicle out every morning. 5 days a week at the moment. We're just on the cusp of opening the weekends with the help of volunteers, and we deliver nutritious breakfast for people between 7 and 10 in the morning. We rely heavily on volunteers to help us with that and supporters who help us with the provision of the foodstuffs, and our staff then cook the meals, prepare the meals, and we distribute them into the community.
And so when you've been going out and doing that, is that something, when you're doing that, have you seen a difference in the last couple of months since the closure of the hub, or is that something that, like, you have stepped up in your efforts to do that since the closure of the hub?
I think it's fair to say that the need in the community has been growing, and that the hub was meeting a lot of that need in the facility that they were operating on Nickel Street. When the facility closed, the need didn't go away, and other service providers, including the Salvation Army and including the Island Crisis Care, who were operating out of the hub, have really stepped up what they're able to do through other means. And one of the means has been to take the services to the street, mobilize through different vehicles, and trying to provide the supports that people still desperately need.
And we're talking about this new multiple-story building that is going to be opening up in June. How is it going as far as meeting the staffing needs that will accompany that?
The staffing needs are covered. The Salvation Army has adequate staffing, and we're going to be moving over a period of a couple of weeks from the building that we're operating in currently into the new facility, bringing our offsite kitchen back into the Salvation Army building on 19 Nickel, and all of the meals will be prepared and served here. The efficiency of that will help us to be able to expand the number of people that we're serving. So we will be opening our doors to people who are not staying with us, but who still need access to a warm meal and a place to sit down with safety and comfort and dignity.
Now, obviously, in an ideal world, there wouldn't be a need for shelters like this. How do you evaluate success with what you're doing?
That's a very interesting question that you've asked, because yes, in an ideal world, there wouldn't be a need for shelter. There would be sufficient supports for people to thrive and people to be successful. But we are in a society where people do fall through the cracks for multiple reasons. And when things fall apart, they tend to fall apart dramatically, and they tend to continue to fall apart until services, community services intervene and provide help, and then we can help to move people in an upward trajectory where they can increase their own capacity for health and self-determination. That does require patience, and it does require time. But the Salvation Army has been working here in Nanaimo since 1888, and will continue to do so long as there is people who are in need of food, who are in need of shelter, who are in need of compassion, who are in need of counseling, direction, and spiritual care.
The building we're talking in is in a very prominent location in Nanaimo. Anyone who's kind of driving by on the main highway is going to see the building. They might not necessarily ever go in it. Is there a message that you would want to share with the community about the work that gets done?
For sure. First, I'd like to extend a warm welcome to anyone who is interested or curious and would like to meet with me or to tour the facility. I'm always willing to do that. I would also very, very strongly like to encourage people to become involved, either through assisting with our meal distribution program in the morning, which relies on volunteers, or through financial contributions that help us to keep our programs operating and to keep the facility open. There is another wonderful opportunity in November on the 25th in the Convention Center, and we will be hosting our annual Hope in the Harbor. That is a luncheon, and it's an event where we present information We explain what the Salvation Army in Nanaimo is doing. We explain what we would like to be able to do in the coming year, and we invite financial support. There is also a quarterly report that's put out about the work that we're doing, and that is on our website, so people can find the information there. But always there are opportunities for volunteers, and always there is a very, very large need for financial support. So those are two huge areas where people can help us.
Is there anything else you'd like to highlight about the renovations or the new services you're hoping to offer real soon?
Only that we are extremely grateful to the city of Nanaimo and to the citizens of Nanaimo for the way that they help us and allow us to be able to work impactfully on the streets of this city. It's a real privilege to be able to meet human beings who are in distress and who are in need of help, and to have the resources to be able to make some change for people and to open doors for opportunity. There is certainly a path forward for disadvantaged individuals to regain health, to be able to function more fully, and to be able to have the autonomy in their lives that the rest of us take for granted.
Byrne, thank you very much for showing me around and taking the time to speak with me.
It's been a great privilege. Thank you.
Byrne Muller is Executive Director of the Salvation Army Nanaimo Center of Hope. We were speaking about renovations to the facility in downtown Nanaimo.
People First Radio and Media are Vancouver Island Mental Health Society education and awareness programs.
Nanaimo's Men's Shed is creating connection and giving back to the community, all while searching for a new space. Men's Shed Canada says a men's shed is a group of men who get together in their community to develop new skills, discover new interests, and make new friends. There are men's sheds in communities around the world. Nanaimo's has meetups every week. They go for coffee on Thursdays, walks on Tuesdays, and also meet up for a monthly lunch. On top of that, they take on various community projects. For example, helping build trellises for a local community garden, or helping local seniors' residences share some simple woodworking projects with residents. Vice President John Boudreau told me the men's shed had been sharing a space with a local nonprofit, but the building was sold, and now they're on the lookout for a new permanent location. In the meantime, they're still meeting out and about in the community. On Tuesday, I joined members of the shed for their weekly walk around Maffeo Sutton Park. The park was particularly loud and lively that day. On the walk, I chatted with member Jim Delorme, who I quickly learned is always on the hunt to recruit new members.
So you meet every Tuesday, and whoever's here, you go on a walk around the harbor?
Yeah. Today, like the first Tuesday of each month, we do a lunch thing right now. Because right now we're shedless or homeless or whatever you want to call it. Because we did have a shed, and then the building got sold, and the new tenants didn't want us in there. They needed the whole building, so we don't have a shed. Our main thing right now is to find a cheap or free-ish location that we can actually set up again for a shed, right?
So how did you get involved with the shed? How did you find out it existed?
I knew about it a couple years ago when they were still on town site at the, I forget the name of the outfit that they were sharing a bit of space with. But I wasn't ready yet to get involved because I wasn't retired and I was busy as hell. And then I decided retirement time is here. And Mrs. Cranky... It was old Cranky's woodworking, by the way. So Mrs. Cranky said, well, you best find yourself something to do before you drive me nuts. So figured I'd join. Now I'm actively involved in recruiting. Oh, hang on a sec. Excuse me, ladies.
Yes.
Do you have old guys at home that are doing nothing and you want them out from underfoot?
Pretty much.
I have cards for the men's shed. The men's shed.
Oh, I'll take one of your cards.
Let's see. Oh, awesome!
Huh? I know, but about you guys.
It gets them out.
I know what you guys. Awesome. Fantastic. Yeah. Every week. I already got one.
Oh, you already got one. Okay. On here, there's a group of them waiting for other people to show up. So I went over there. My cards were all gone.
Okay. So you're not just doing that for the cameras?
No. Recruiting. So when I joined, there was 12. Now we're up to 30. So.
And is there something, like, does anyone need to bring any special skills, or do you need to be able to do anything to join?
Nope. They just need to want to get out. Stop looking at the wall and stuff. If they don't have any skills, that's fine. They might learn something, too. Right.
How do the projects usually come about, like the work you're doing with the seniors' residences?
It's word of mouth. Like a lot of the outfits know that we exist now. We've done stuff at like Possum Gardens or Possum Park. We've done other things for senior homes in Ladysmith. And it's just presence. We're there now, so people will contact us, ask us if we can help them out. So we try to help out wherever we can. We're not there to compete with contractors. We don't want to, like, if someone says, can you build a fence for me? No. There's people that do that. So we're not going to interfere with people's livelihoods, right?
And so right now you're mostly, you're still doing the meetups, you're kind of looking for a new shed.
Yeah, this is trying to keep us all connected that way, eh? So the coffee meetups on Thursdays, and the walks on Tuesdays, and the lunches is just a way to keep everybody connected. And for some of us, it's all they really want is just to meet people, chat, and not feel alone, right?
Well, how have you found? What have you found that it's maybe done for you since you joined?
Oh, it's given me a longer lifespan because my wife isn't wanting to choke me. That's sometimes I feel that's a way I can, like, there was one guy and we were in HomeSense the other day. I was standing in line waiting as she's getting ready to pay, and handed out a card to a guy in the same age group as us, type thing, because he was clowning around a bit. I said, hey, you should join the men's shed. And the wife said, well, I heard of them. I said, yeah, you know, get them out from under your feet. So, hey, he was retired.
So you've always got the cards. You're always everywhere you go, you're ready to hand them out.
Always got cards, yeah. Usually they'll come, like, they'll contact us and they'll say, come join us for one of our coffees and whatnot. See if it's going to fit before you join, right? Because it's an expensive club to join.
Oh, yes.
$25 a year.
Did you know anyone in the club when you joined?
No, I just came, met with them. There was, like I said, there was only a small group of people when I joined. And went from there.
Well, I imagine it must be one thing to, like, have a meetup every week and get to see people. And I imagine it must, like, take it to another level to have some kind of goal or some kind of project that you're working towards every now and then, eh?
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, we get different guys working on it. Our coffee meetups, we don't always have the same people. Sometimes it's 16 or more people there. Sometimes it's less. The walks, we've only got us here this morning, but as the weather gets nicer, and we'll get more and more people.
So the pitch is kind of it's just come for the projects or the woodworking and stay for the community?
Come for the social connection and then stay for whatever you choose to. Because that's the biggest thing. When guys my age and older are retired, it's a small circle. So you need to expand that, right? And if you're still married, extends your life.
Following the walk, I chatted with some of the members after we stopped into a bustling cafe on Nanaimo's harborfront.
Well, there's that stereotype that, you know, men don't love to open up emotionally. And
well, you're of an age where you weren't encouraged to open up emotionally. You're a lot younger than I am, and of course, the different generations, that's changed. When I was young, it wasn't permissible for a man to be crying or showing any forms of weakness, you know. Whereas today, that's not the case. Generally, that's not the case. There are probably still groups of men that are uncomfortable with other men showing their emotions. Maybe certain professions, maybe military, policing. But generally speaking, it's a lot easier for men to express themselves than it used to be.
There's over 3,000 sheds around the world. It was started back in the 1900s in Australia. And over there, I guess the guys used to always have a shed in their backyard. And they'd hang out in there, have a beer or whatever. So that's kind of where the shed came from. But in Canada, we've really grown in the last couple of years. There's now a Men's Shed Canada, which has been a great resource. There's lots of things they've done. For example, they'll build kits for, say, publicity. If I wanted to do a press release or whatever, I don't have to create that. I can go get one of their kits and do it. So really, and good support.
Is the hunt for a new shed, well, first of all, is that something that's kind of active? Are you looking for help on that front? Like if there's some other group that has a space they don't always use? Or
yeah, we've been looking since we had to move. And I've got a contact in the city and another one that on the school board. So, yeah, we're still looking, but it's pretty tough to find a place here. Right? And we don't have lots of money, so it's not like even if you, the commercial real estate here is pretty expensive, and it's tough to find this type of space, right? So we just haven't yet, but if we do, we still have a bit of money aside to buy tools to move in, sort of thing. So, yeah. So if you hear anything, let us know.
Well, what do you need from a space?
We used to talk about maybe 600-800 square feet, just an open shop space, right? And ideally a nice room for a meeting, so we could just meet in there all the time. But not much after that. You know. So somebody's got more. Yeah. Great.
John Boudreau is vice president of the Nanaimo and District Men's Shed Society. You can find more information on the group's website or their Facebook page, which is called Men's Shed Nanaimo. That's it for the show today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. You can find past interviews and segments from the show on our podcast feed. Search People First Radio on Google or YouTube or Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.